So welcome. Thanks, Thomas, for the introduction. Thanks for having me. It's a great honor. It's in fact a great adventure for me. It's my first trip to China, my second trip ever to Asia, and the first one was to a very different part of Asia, to Turkey. And in fact, I'd like to take you all on an adventure today and over the following 4 days. I'd like to take you on an adventure exploring the human mind. I'll be our tour guide, but our roadmap and our means of transport and even our means of exploration, our microscope or telescope or looking glass, whatever metaphor works for you, will be language. So we'll be looking at what we can learn from language about the human mind, what language teaches us about the human mind, and we're going to specifically look at what linguistic diversity, cross-linguistic variation, and how languages frame the world, represent reality, can teach us about the mind. Thank you. Okay, so, this is great, because now I can walk, which I really like to do. Okay, let's get started. There you go. Okay, so this first lecture will be mostly an introduction, overview, and some background that we need for what's going to follow. So we'll start with the topic. The course will focus, or the lecture series will focus on two topics, namely the title is Field Methods in Cognitive Linguistics. Now, field methods is something that you need for studying any linguistic phenomenon in the field, whether it's syntax, phonology, morphology, but we're going to be interested specifically in field semantics. So we're going to look specifically at methods for studying semantics in the field, bless you, and at semantic typology. Those are the main topics of this series of lectures. And in fact, we're going to focus on field semantics during lectures 2 to 4 and on semantic typology during lectures 5 to 10. So we start with field semantics. What do I mean by field semantics? Basically, I'm going to try to introduce some methods and some theoretical background, epistemology, meaning the theory of how you get to know stuff in this particular field, methods and epistemology for what I call empirical semantics, which is more gadgets. I'm now stuffed with gadgets. I have at least 3 of these on me. Probably I'm going to explode at some point. Methods for the empirical study of semantics, meaning the study of linguistic meaning on the basis of observation rather than interpretation. And I'll explain in a second what I mean by that. Semantic typology, on the other hand, is the cross-linguistic study of semantic categorization. So that's where we're looking at how different languages represent, frame reality, the world, and what that teaches us about the human mind. And you see there's a relation between these things because you need this in order to study this. So the data for semantic typology primarily come from semantic fieldwork. we generally have to go and collect primary data on how speakers of different languages frame a particular kind of stimulus, a particular kind of object or action or spatial relation. And then we can do analysis, typological analysis. We can compare and try to find out what the languages of the world have in common in this respect and how they differ from one another. And what is that good for? So it gives us a chance to sort out universals and variability in semantic representation. That in turn, as I'll explain in a second, will allow us to map the nature-nurture divide in cognition, meaning it allows us to tell what aspects of human cognition are possibly innate and universal and what are learned and culture-specific and therefore variable across human populations. But more than that, this kind of research also helps us understand how the language-cognition interface works, meaning how language might affect non-linguistic thinking in different populations, different peoples, and conversely, how cognition affects what is expressed in language. And finally, we can use semantic typology as a window into the syntax-semantics interface, the principles that govern the mapping between linguistic meaning and linguistic form, morphosyntactic form, morphology, and syntax. And I'm going to illustrate that with examples shortly. All right, now I want to contrast this program against what I call a traditional field methods course, which is the way field methods is taught in the places that have a tradition for teaching it. I don't know whether China has a tradition of teaching field methods. Russia does, the United States do, the Netherlands do, actually, a few places in the world do. Now, the way it's taught in the United States, including by me, it's in my department, in my university, it's a two-semester course, and we get a speaker of some indigenous language that the students don't speak and that I don't speak, and that student will be our consultant, our informant, the person from which we collect data, just like real field workers collect data from the speakers of indigenous languages in the field. So that kind of course is very much praxis-oriented. It's very much focused on learning by doing, which is important because fieldwork is ultimately not a theoretical endeavor. It's a practical endeavor. It's something that you do and therefore that you can learn only by practice. So that kind of practice you're not going to get in this course because, well, you can't convey that in lectures because people won't learn it unless they actually get a chance to do it. So what I mean to tell you is this course is going to focus on the theoretical side of fieldwork. It's going to focus on methods and epistemology. And that can't quite compensate for the experience that you can get from taking a field methods course in this folk format here, or more importantly, even more powerful, just going to the field and doing field work yourself. That's ultimately how anybody who has ever done field work has learned it, mostly. All right. Okay, so once again, the first three lectures are going to focus on field semantics, on how we can gather, extract, collect data for semantic analyses. And the remaining six lectures are going to focus on five lectures. I'm mathematically challenged. The remaining five lectures are going to six. It is six. The remaining six. It's wonderful to know that all this stuff is going to wind. It's going to be recorded, and never mind. Preserved for all history. The remaining six lectures are going to focus on what we can do with cross-linguistic data on linguistic semantics. And the question is, how does all of this relate to cognitive linguistics? My rationale for focusing on field semantics, apart from the fact that that's my specialty, I do work on semantics and on semantic typology, my rationale for doing this under the heading of this is that, of course, linguistic meaning is one of the central areas of research in cognitive linguistics. And understanding the relationship between non-linguistic cognition, thought, reasoning, and language is surely one of the goals of cognitive linguistics. And semantic typology is one important means of accomplishing this goal. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about field research to enrich this concept a little bit, get a better sense of what we mean by field research. That's a concept that's used very widely across different academic disciplines. You have it throughout the humanities, but also outside the humanities, in the life sciences, the geosciences, and even in opinion research, for example, or market research, marketing research. And it always means something slightly different. Every discipline has its own particular take on field research, but what they all have in common is it's research in situ, meaning in place. It's studying the phenomena in the place where they occur. So let's take a look at what this means just in the various disciplines that are close to linguistics. Starting with anthropology, so for those who know the classical four-field theory of anthropology, according to which anthropology comprises... Oh, that bit the dust. Archaeology, physical anthropology or paleontology, cultural anthropology, and linguistic anthropology. Each of these fields has its own approach to fieldwork. For archaeologists and paleontologists, of course, fieldwork means digging, going someplace and excavating some ruins or some, ancient human bones and so on and so forth. For cultural anthropologists, fieldwork means participant observation, going to the community they wish to study and living with the people, immersing themselves in their ways, trying to become a functional member of the community and thereby learning what it takes to be a functional member of the community, meaning learning the practices of this culture, learning the procedural knowledge that one needs to have in order to function as a competent member of a cultural community. That's participant observation. And then in linguistic anthropology, you will do that, but you will also use the field methods that structural linguists use, which is what we're going to be talking about in these lectures. Now, in sociology, fieldwork primarily means interviews, same as in opinion research and so on and so forth. So you have a questionnaire and you go and interview a large sample of people, record their responses, and then do a statistical analysis over it. Finally, in linguistics, as a matter of fact, we do all of the above. There are at least four different approaches to fieldwork within linguistics. Starting with the linguistic anthropologists who combine methods of cultural anthropology and methods of structural linguistics, and often also methods of sociology. So they may, for example, run interviews on the basis of questionnaires, but also interact with a community for a long period of time in order to study the members in participant observation. You then have the sociolinguists in the tradition that is mainly that was mainly created by Bill Labov, in which people primarily rely on interview data, questionnaire data. Then you have the traditional dialectologists, an approach to the study of dialect diversification, the distribution of the different dialects of a language, which originates from 19th century historical linguistics. And the traditional approach to dialect geography is basically for a single researcher to go from village to village and in each village identify what they call the most conservative speaker, which typically is an older, not well-educated male. And then they record that speaker, have him pronounce a few words, say a few sentences, and so on and so forth. And finally, you have the structural linguists, and I'm including here the semanticists, meaning the people who study language as a semiotic system. Its syntax, its morphology, its phonology, its semantics. All of that I'm including under structural linguists. So what we do is we mainly rely on three sources of data. We do, to some extent and to an increasing extent nowadays, record spontaneous conversations as they occur without the intervention of the researcher, but that's often very hard to do in traditional communities because it's not something that people necessarily welcome. It may be something that they find very disruptive. Aside from that, and that's of course that's the type of research that's particularly important for conversation analysis. If you're interested in studying the strategies that people use to manage their conversations, which is something that you cannot do if the researcher, you as the researcher, are influencing what is happening. But aside from that, syntacticians, semanticists, and so on and so forth mostly rely on these two sources of evidence, recording what Nicholas Himmelmann has called stage discourses, such as shoving a microphone into a speaker's face and asking them, okay, tell me a story. And of course, they will tell you a traditional story, just as they would a child in the community, or even an adult in the community. So the story you're getting may be a more or less conventional, traditional format that you didn't have any influence on. But nevertheless, this is called staged because the reason this story is told at this particular moment in time is because you, the researcher, asked the speaker to tell you that story. So it's not a naturally occurring event. And finally, there's elicitation, and that's going to be our main focus of emphasis. What does elicitation mean? It means that you provide the speaker with a particular task and a stimulus to which they respond. And the stimulus may be an utterance in their native language or in a contact language. It may be a picture that you ask them to describe. It may be an utterance in their own native language that you ask them to judge as to whether it's well-formed or not, and so on and so forth. All right. Now, what exactly do I mean by in situ? This is actually a tricky question, because in situ suggests that you're studying the phenomenon as it naturally occurs, but as I already mentioned, you have to generally assume that the observation interferes with the occurrence of the phenomenon. And this is something that the different disciplines that do field work try to take into account in different ways. For example, the sociolinguists have long observed that the responses you get to a questionnaire actually depend on whether people, the respondents, perceive the interviewer as somebody who is a member of the community themselves or not. So there's a classic study by Peter Trudgill conducted in the early 1970s. In northeastern England, where he was able to get people to respond in their working class, their local working class dialect pronunciations, because Trudgill himself, despite the fact that he was a university professor, was using these kinds of pronunciations. So he was being perceived as a member of the local community, and without that, people would not have responded in that way. They would have used standard English pronunciation. Now, in structural linguistics, we have a very peculiar understanding of what it means to do fieldwork, which has been influenced by a very peculiar history of this field of structural linguistics, which, as we're going to see, has been sort of meandering its way between the humanities and the social and behavioral sciences. Over the history of modern linguistics, which is basically a field that developed in the 20th century, you have a whole lot of idealizations which have accumulated due to the heritage of linguistics, which mostly comes out of the humanities. And as a result, it is often assumed that as long as you're collecting data from a speaker of the language, that's fieldwork. It doesn't actually matter where you collect the data or who this person is that you collect the data from, and so on and so forth. One speaker anywhere in the world, maybe in a hotel room, it may be in a classroom, that counts as fieldwork. That is a very widespread notion, and it's a problematic notion. Because, of course, there is, there's pretty much no way that what is going to happen here is a fair representation of what happens naturally in the community. But that was our original naive understanding of the meaning of in situ. Okay, and then, of course, nowadays, those of us who do field work are increasingly concerned with preserving linguistic diversity, or maybe not linguistic diversity itself, because that is often a bar that's set too high already for what we can achieve. Nowadays, we mostly struggle to preserve a record of the linguistic diversity that we find on the planet now, as this diversity is unfortunately rapidly diminishing, and more languages become obsolete. They are no longer spoken by the members of the ancestral community. And of course, when you're faced with that kind of situation where you have very few full speakers left, and maybe all the full speakers are left that are left are in their 70s or 80s. Maybe, in fact, the language is pretty much no longer used in the community. Maybe they're two elderly ladies and they live on opposite sides of town, and they don't really have much contact, and only when they get together once a year is the language still spoken. So then, of course, what exactly it means to do field work under these conditions is a whole different ball game. And it's a challenge that many of those of us who are interested in doing field work have been facing. As a matter of fact, it's also something that has been motivating a whole new generation of students to go into linguistics and learn the trade of documenting and describing endangered languages and going out and producing a record that might be of use for the study of the human mind, because every language is an invaluable data point in understanding the human mind, but also for the community of speakers in case one day they want to try to revive the language. All right. Field semantics. So, this is the study of... Okay, no longer have it on the whiteboard. It's the study of semantics in the field, under field conditions. And the question I want to ask right now is, why would you do that? Why are people interested in doing that? So field semantics is something that occurs for a number of different reasons. First of all, field semantics has its place in language description and language documentation. And what I mean by that is basically, language description produces a scientific record of the language that linguists and cognitive scientists can use to study the grammar and lexicon of that language. What do I mean by language documentation? Language documentation is a scientific record of how the speakers use the language. It's a scientific record of the linguistic practices. And that's going to be important for a lot of researchers who want to study the language and the community of speakers. Anthropologists, conversation analysts, people working in linguistic pragmatics, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, the documentation ideally also would enable the speakers of the language, or rather the members of the community, possibly at a point where the language has become obsolete, to revive it. Which is something that is actually happening in a number of cases around the world. So indigenous languages that were no longer spoken for a period of 100 years or more are now slowly coming back thanks to whatever records are in fact available. So one case in point is the Algonquian language of Martha's Vineyard, an island off the coast of Massachusetts. The language called Wampanoag, which wasn't spoken since the early 1900s. And nowadays, members of the Wampanoag community, whose native language, of course, is English, are learning their ancestral language again. Semantics has its place in language description and documentation, just as syntax and phonology have their place. But as a matter of fact, the people who typically go out to study and describe and document languages in the field primarily have the training to study syntax and phonology and not semantics. Why? Because, our field, the field of linguistics, has had a bias towards syntax for the last 50, 60 years, more or less since the Chomskyan turn in linguistics, and it has a bias towards phonology and morphology and syntax for an even longer term, I mean pretty much since the inception of modern linguistics. So, as a result, people typically don't have the training they need to study semantics in the field. And, of course, a result of that is that the semantic side of language descriptions often lacks, is found wanting, and you have, maybe people confusing, mistaking, let's say, perfective aspects for past tenses because they happen to be more familiar with past tenses, or they're mistaking an evidential marker for a perfect aspect because they're more familiar with a perfect aspect. So in other words, Eurocentrism, essentially, or more generally speaking, a bias towards whatever the researcher knows about their own language and related languages is the result. And that's one of the reasons why when you're doing semantic typology, you have to usually go and collect the data yourself, because existing language descriptions, grammars and lexicons, dictionaries that you take off the shelf, are not going to give you the answers for how particular ideas are expressed in the languages of the world, because that's not what the researcher who compiled the grammar looked at. Okay, next, there is also a growing body of research on semantics in the field that is directly driven by theoretical goals, meaning the people go and study semantics in the field because they have a theoretically inspired question, such as within cognitive linguistics, questions that are, for example, inspired by Anna Wischbitzker's natural semantic meta-language program. So people want to know how certain proposed semantic primitives are expressed in different languages and whether they truly are primitives. There has been a lot of research inspired... Oops, I'm sorry. Wow. A lot of research inspired by the work of my colleague Len Tami, who also gave lectures in this forum a few years ago. Research inspired by Ray Jackendorf's conceptual semantics. I've done some work on the basis of that myself. And outside cognitive linguistics and formal semantics, there's also a growing interest in fieldwork and a growing community of fieldworking semanticists. And one of the forums that have developed over the last 10 years is a series of conferences called Semantics of Underrepresented Languages in the Americas, which focuses on formal semantics in Native American languages. And we had the most recent one at Cornell University this May. Right, and finally, there is research in field semantics driven by semantic typology, which is my own main line of research, the cross-linguistic study of linguistic categorization. So, example, color term systems, which is something that we'll talk about more extensively in the fifth lecture, I want to say. So, what do you have here? You have, on the one hand, languages such as English, or I believe Mandarin, which at the level of basic words, meaning words that are morphologically simple and they're used by every speaker of the language, they're not loan words, or at least not easily recognizable as loan words, at that level of so-called basic color terms. Basic color terms. A distinction between blue and green. On the other hand, there are many languages that have a basic level distinction between dark blue and light blue. That's not the case in English, but it is the case in Russian and Turkish and Persian and many other languages of that particular area. And then there are many languages like Yucatec Maya, the indigenous language that I've been studying for 20 years, which has a single word for green and blue, a word that means something like grew, green and blue. Now, this is not colorful. It doesn't cover orange or yellow or brown or what have you. It's just green and blue. And of course, the question is, given this kind of cross-linguistic variation, are there any constraints on this? Are there principles that the languages of the world share that govern the structure of color terminologies? And if so, what does that suggest about the role of cognition, non-linguistic perception and categorization of color in language? And conversely, what does it suggest about the role of linguistic color terms in cognition? So, for example, is it the case that Yucatec speakers find green and blue more similar to one another than English speakers, and English speakers find light blue and dark blue more similar to one another than Russian speakers? And the answer, by the way, to the last question is yes, they do. Okay, so then as typologists, as semantic typologists, we map the distribution over different categorization strategies across the languages of the world, which is what typologists basically do. They map the distribution of linguistic phenomena of syntax, phonology, or semantics. So here you have a map from the World Atlas of Language Structures that shows the distribution of green-blue distinctions across the languages of the world. And the red dots are languages that have distinct basic color terms for red and blue, whereas the yellow circles are languages that have a single term for green and blue. And then the other stuff, and as typologists, we're trying to formulate generalizations over this distribution. We're trying to find principles that govern this distribution. And in the case of color terminologies, originally Berlin and Kay, 1969, proposed a set of generalizations. And the latest manifestation of these generalizations were proposed by Paul Kay and Louisa Maffei in the late 90s. You see them here. What this basically means is that if a language has basic color term systems, then the simplest way of doing that is to have just two terms, one that covers all the light warm colors and one that covers all the dark cool colors. And then if you have three terms, you have to break out white. You have to have a distinct term for white. There are different routes that you can take to by and by break up the so-called multifocal colors into single focal colors until you reach this inventory of six basic monofocal basic color terms. We'll talk more about that later. Okay, so that was a quick roadmap, very simplified roadmap of what semantic typologists do. Now, the question is, why do they do that? What's the goal? What's the big idea? Why is this interesting? Why do we do this kind of thing? Why do we want to study semantic categorization across languages? And the answer in a nutshell, well, this is sort of the bumper sticker answer, meaning it's a very simplified version of the answer, is that studying linguistic categorization allows us to distinguish between what's variable in terms of semantic categorization and what's non-variable. And that in turn allows us, it gives us a pretty good guess at least at what's culturally transmitted learned knowledge and what's potentially innate knowledge. All right, so that's what I mean. I wrote a white paper for the National Science Foundation, basically telling them that they need to fund this kind of research, which, of course, you know, I mean, you could argue I have some vested interest in, I suppose. So I called this mapping the nature-nurture divide in cognition, where nurture, of course, is a metaphor for culture. So what we're trying to do is find out where in the human mind, in cognition, the dividing line between learned and innate knowledge runs, because we expect innate knowledge to be invariable across human populations and learned knowledge to be culture-specific and therefore surface in the form of cross-linguistic variation. And in the process of doing this, we also have to clarify the relation between non-linguistic cognition, internal thought and reasoning, memory and so on and so forth, and language. How does cognition influence language? How does language influence cognition? Which, of course, is the Whorfian question, the linguistic relativity hypothesis. That's this arrow up here. And as I already said, in the process, we also try to contribute to theories of the syntax-semantics interface. And I'm going to illustrate that in a moment. All right, so some background. Since we'll be talking a lot about knowledge and representation and cognition, let me give you, in a nutshell, some very naive, heavily simplified characterizations. I'm not even going to call them definitions of what I mean by all these things. And I'm giving you a somewhat longer answer in the appendix to the handout for today's lecture, but we don't have time to go over all of this stuff in detail. One thing that's important to me to clarify is all of this stuff is very much in flux for me. So my thinking about this these issues constantly evolves. It could easily be... So this is what you're seeing here has been the result of 20 years of thinking of evolution, and if I'm still alive another 20 years from now, then I hope that at best I'm going to be laughing at this. All right. So what do I mean by representation? Basically, one entity or state of affairs standing for another entity, conveying some sort of information about another entity or state of affairs. And a representation, in some sense, is always a sign. It's not necessarily symbolic. It doesn't have to be a conventional sign. But if Charles Saunders Peirce's classic classification of signs is correct, then every representation can relate to that which it represents in exactly three possible ways. As a symbol, meaning by way of convention, a learned connection culturally transmitted, or as an index, meaning something that stands in a causal or contiguity relationship with that which it stands for. Imagine footsteps on a beach as a representation of the person or animal who walked there, or smoke as a representation of fire, clouds, storm clouds as a representation of a coming storm system, and so on and so forth. Well, this morning I stepped on the scale in my bathroom and it gave me a reading, which then gave me pause, but that reading is an indexical representation of my body weight. And my body weight is going up thanks to the great food in this country. And you have iconic representations, which are representations constituted by similarity between the representation and that which it stands for, such as a picture, a map, a painting, a film, the video recording of these lectures, the handout in some sense, the structure of the handout is an iconic representation of the structure of the lectures and so on and so forth. Okay, so I have a very, very broad and wide sense of representation, and I certainly don't mean by representation just symbolic representation, which is important because I think that has led to this equation of representation with symbolic representation has led to a lot of confusion in cognitive science. Next, what do I mean by meaning? Well, that is the information that the representation conveys about that which it represents. And again, you know, that sounds like it's the most easy, straightforward, trivial thing in the world, but as a matter of fact, it's, you know, the hard part is explaining what the heck we mean by information. And that's what semantic theory tries to do. Next, cognition. What is cognition? This is probably the most difficult one of the four. I'm going to take a roundabout route by first trying to define the notion of a cognitive agent, a cognizer, if you will, which can be a human being, it can be an animal, it can be a robot, doesn't matter. A cognitive agent is a biological or artificial entity that is capable of generating and processing representations of its own internal states and of its environment. And it's possible, I mean, it's capable of acting. Not sure that's an essential, necessary part of the definition, but of course, we certainly expect cognitive agents to some extent to be able to act on these representations and therefore possibly change their environment. And cognition then is both the process of generating and processing these representations and also the ability to do so, to process, to generate and process these representations. Okay, finally, what about culture? Culture is the sharing of representations between cognitive agents. What do I mean by that? It's the sharing of knowledge. Both the two important flavors of knowledge that are distinguished in cognitive science, called procedural and declarative knowledge. Declarative knowledge is knowledge of facts that you can convey linguistically in terms of linguistically encoded propositions, such as, let's say, the kind of knowledge that you learn in history class at school. Procedural knowledge is knowledge how to do something, which you basically can only learn by doing, which, remember what I said about fieldwork, since ultimately fieldwork is a practical enterprise, you have to actually do it in order to learn it. Same as you know, the knowledge you need to ride a bike. It's not knowledge you can get from somebody explaining to you how you can ride, what you need to do to ride a bike. That explanation may be perfectly sound, but it does not by itself enable you to ride a bike. You simply have to go and try it and learn it yourself. So that's procedural knowledge. The sharing, the social sharing of both procedural and declarative knowledge is culture, but also the social sharing of practices, meaning it's not necessarily just the knowledge of what people do, it's the doing itself, the habitual doing, the styles of action, the styles of speaking, the styles of walking, of comporting yourself, dressing, responding to particular gestures, but also cognitive styles, styles of thinking, of reasoning, which are shared among the members of a community. And you're going to say, well, wait a minute, how is that possible? How is it possible for the members of a society to share styles of reasoning? How the heck are they going to do that? Are they going to be telepathic or what? And the answer is, well, we can infer styles of reasoning from the actions, the behavior of other members of our community. We can infer those to some extent from their non-linguistic actions, but in particular, we can infer their styles of thinking from their gestures and from their use of language. And that is going to be one of the bigger topics of some of the lectures that are ahead of us. Okay, as I said, these are just sort of thumbnail sketches. You get a longer story of what I have in mind when I talk about some of these things in the appendix of the handout. All right, so any kind of knowledge is going to be either innate or learned. And if it's learned, it's going to be either learned from individual experience, such as the famous stereotypical hot plate on a stove that supposedly every child has to touch in order to learn that that's not a good idea. So that's learning from individual experience. And then there's knowledge that's culturally transmitted. And this is a huge chunk of everything that we know. Notice, cultural transmission of knowledge is what's happening right here, right now. I'm transmitting knowledge to you. And you're also transmitting knowledge to me because, you know, I'm looking at you guys, I'm studying you, I'm trying to make some inferences about audiences in these kinds of lectures in China, I'm trying to learn about that. And probably what I'm coming up with is a lot of very invalid generalizations, partly because the sample is too small. But be that as it may, all of us do this all the time. And a lot of what we know, mathematics, music, the law, economics, this huge bulk of human knowledge, this enormous body of human knowledge, is not innate. None of it is innate. All of it is cultural, and therefore we possess this knowledge, neither because it's in our DNA, in our genes, nor because we figured it out ourselves, but rather because we learned it from our parents, our teachers, our friends and peers, and so on and so forth. In other words, through cultural transmission. All right, so this means, and this is very sort of abridged and simplified rationale, anything that you find, any aspects of human knowledge that are variable across human populations are generally assumed not to be innate. And the underlying rationale for this argument, for this analysis, is that there are no established cognitive differences across human populations. We know there are some genetic differences across human populations, although these are apparently very, very superficial. That doesn't mean that people haven't given them enormous meaning, usually with very negative consequences. But genetically, biologically, these differences that express themselves in pigmentation and so on and so forth are very shallow. And as far as we know, there's no evidence, in other words, that suggests that there are any cognitive differences that are genetically transmitted. So in other words, we have reason to assume that whenever we observe culture-specific differences in human behavior, the relevant behavior has to be learned. It cannot be innate, because then it wouldn't be variable. And on the other hand, if we observe an aspect of human behavior across populations that's not variable, then one possible explanation for that uniformity is innateness, but it's not the only explanation. It may also be that this talking just about linguistic behavior and about language, the structures of language that we observe, or for example, the structure of semantic representations that we as semantic typologists study. We observe that if there is an absence of variation, maybe one reason for that is because the general design features of language, the very highest ranking design features, such as the fact that there is the so-called double articulation in the sound structure of languages, so you have meaning-bearing and meaning-distinguishing elements, meaning morphemes and phonemes, and these things are not identical. There will be properties of language that just follow from these general design features. So the properties that are entailed by the general design features do not have to be innate, even if some of the design features are innate. And finally, there is the possibility of monogenesis and inheritance from the common ancestor, the putative, hypothetical common ancestor of all surviving human languages, if there was such a common ancestor. Since by some accounts, human language is a very recent phenomenon and has only been around for a few 10,000s of years, we may be able to trace back all extant human languages to a single ancestor. Not in actual fact, we haven't been able to do that. But some people think it is possible in principle, and therefore a lot of the traits that we observe across human languages, the human languages that exist today, occur just because they have been handed down through the lineages that have evolved from the common ancestor. Of course, there are several problems with this argument. First of all, monogenesis isn't assured. And I guess we should have a break, so I'll talk a little bit about that after the break. Monogenesis isn't a foregone conclusion, I think. In addition, there are new languages which don't descend from the common ancestor, Pidgin and Creole languages. So if those languages show the same feature, then the argument wouldn't carry over to that. But finally, aside from all these other possibilities, there is the possibility of innateness. So one possible explanation for why a certain feature is shared across the human languages might be innateness. So I wanted to say two more things about this picture here. Two, if you will, caveats. One, I think the picture overall is, in a sense, a little bit naive, maybe, because when I make this distinction between innate and learned knowledge, I implicitly assume that cognition needs to rely on knowledge and that knowledge is something static. But you could also take a more dynamic view on cognition in terms of categorization or conceptualization, the dynamic processes involved in forming concepts. And if you do that, then maybe cognition doesn't need any kind of innate categories, any kind of genetically encoded knowledge that we have from birth. All it really needs is something like an innate categorization engine which forms concepts in predictable ways in response to environmental stimuli. And of course, part of those environmental stimuli are going to be the cultural and linguistic data that the child learns from other members of the community. So this opposition between innate and learned knowledge, this is something that people have been, most people in cognitive science, have been taking for granted since the inception of cognitive science, because the basic idea of cognitive science is that the mind does not start as a blank slate. Tabula rasa, as they say in Latin, but rather with some sort of pre-setting that allows children to learn other stuff. But I believe that that's not necessarily true. And secondly, this stuff here, the idea that human languages may share a property simply because these properties descend from a common ancestor. So this is a hot new topic of research that has been generating a lot of very interesting and provocative studies over the, well, in recent years, thanks to the new availability of methods of phylogenetic statistics originally developed in evolutionary biology, which we can now use to compare languages, the features of different languages, and come up with likely scenarios for the evolution of these features. We'll talk a little bit more about that in, I think it's lecture 7, the lecture on quantitative methods in semantic typology. But I want to say I'm skeptical about this line of research for several reasons, including the fact that I'm not sold on monogenesis. I'm not convinced that all extant human languages must have come from a single common ancestor. And one reason to be skeptical about this is the fact that there is a lot of circumstantial evidence to the effect that ancient humans, meaning Neanderthals and so on and so forth, already had some form of language. For example, just last week there was an article in the journal Science that pointed out that a lot of the drawings of hand shapes that you find in the case of Europe probably were made not by modern humans but by Neanderthals, because the hand doesn't quite have the shape of the modern human hand, and because it also seems to be too old. I mean, some of these drawings seem to be simply too old for modern humans, to have been made by modern humans, which suggests that Neanderthals already had symbolic art, as they call it. They most certainly controlled fire. They had complex hunting techniques that it's very hard to imagine how they could have shared them culturally among one another without some form of language. And if they had some form of language, that means that modern humans, who most assuredly are all related to a single group of common ancestors that originated in Africa. But modern humans could have easily picked up language from ancient humans in different parts of the world separately, which essentially would mean that human language as we know it may have had multiple origins, although all of these ultimately would develop from whatever proto-language was spoken by ancient humans. That's all speculation. All I'm trying to say is monogenesis is not necessarily something that we should take for granted. All right. Finally, there was a very important paper by Nick Evans and Steve Levinson in Brain and Behavioral Sciences in 2010 or 2009, where they point out something that most people in cognitive science are not aware of, which is there are very few, if any, strong language universals. Meaning very strong, very few principles that hold for all languages without exceptions. So according to Evans and Levinson, the emphasis on language universals has been strongly overblown. I agree with that wholeheartedly, but I think there is another side of the picture which Evans and Levinson omit, which is that, yes, there are a lot of striking similarities across the languages of the world in terms of the meanings that are expressed. And these similarities, even if they're not exceptionless, even if there are to any possible generalization that you can come up with, there will be one or two or 10 or 20 languages that don't conform to that exception. You still have to explain why it is that thousands of other languages do share certain feature. And that's a very important task of semantic typologists and also of other typologists, I think. All right, so these are three different versions of what I call the big picture, which you got in the blueprint a moment ago. So the relation between nature and culture on the one hand and the relation between language and non-linguistic cognition on the other. The first version of the big picture was assumed by these gentlemen. This is Franz Boas, Edward Sapir, Benjamin Lee Wolff. This is pretty much what people on both sides of the Atlantic took for granted until after World War II. Until the advent of the cognitive sciences. And according to this picture, most of cognition and language, in fact, probably all except for trivial parts, would be learned, would not be innate, would therefore not be determined by biology, and language would play a very important part in shaping the categories of thought of internal cognition. Then came the cognitive revolution, the cognitive turn, the rise of the cognitive sciences, and in linguistics, the rise of generative grammar, Chomskyan linguistics. With that new program, people have emphasized very much the inverse of this picture, a version according to which almost everything interesting about cognition is innate, and the only parts that are learned are trivial and uninteresting. Language has almost no role in internal cognition, except a more or less trivial function in defining certain constraints on what can be expressed and therefore what's useful to entertain in the way of thought. By and large, what is expressed in language simply is an external representation of internal thought. And that's the version of the big picture that has been championed and advocated by Noam Chomsky, Jerry Fodor, Lila Gleitman, and many others. I would say it's still in the United States today, if there is a dominant paradigm, and there is a dominant paradigm. I'm not sure that's still true of Europe or Asia, but in the United States it's still true, and this would be it. And then there is the neo-Worfians who have been tearing, drilling holes into this version of the picture, and basically have been trying to demolish it for the last 20 years, such as Steve Levinson, Melissa Bowerman, Dan Slobin. And the version that they have been advocating is something that is somewhat in between these two. So there is a role possibly for biology in cognition and language that is a little more substantial than what Wolff and his contemporaries assumed. But on the other hand, it is definitely true that a very significant part of cognition is cultural, is learned and socially shared, and language plays an important role in that because it is a very important means of transmitting cultural knowledge. Not the only one, but a very important one, possibly the most powerful one that humans have at their disposal. All right, so now I wanted to give some brief examples to illustrate how we can get from semantic typology to research about the mind and cognition. And the first example is the classic research on basic color terms by Berlin and Kay. So Berlin and Kay went and gave a bunch of a standardized set of color chips to speakers of 20 different languages and asked them, how do you call this stuff? What colors are the best instances of the basic color terms? They found that there were some principles that were shared across the speakers of these different languages, including in what chips served as the best instances, the best exemplars of the colors. Eleanor Roche then developed the theory of prototype categorization in cognition that was heavily inspired by Berlin and Kay's work. Kay and McDaniel proposed in 1978 the neural substrate hypothesis, which tries to attribute the findings, the generalizations of Berlin and Kay, directly to properties of the neurophysiological processing of color perception. That, in the meantime, has turned out to no longer be tenable. It was based on data from color perception research in the 1960s that was shown to be invalid later. But still, sooner or later, people are going to try to go there again and build a bridge all the way from the observable linguistic data to the underlying neurophysiological substrate. In 1984, Paul Kay and Willard Kempton demonstrated a weak Wharfian effect of color categorization. In other words, they were able to show that speakers of Tarahumara, which is a language that, like Yucatec, has a single word for green and blue, do indeed, if you run a similarity judgment task, find shades of green and blue more similar to one another than English speakers do. And more recently, Terry Regier and colleagues replicated these experiments, and they were able to show something very intriguing, which is that these Wharfian effects, these language-specific effects, only manifest themselves in the left hemisphere. So if you shut your left eye and you only get the stimuli administered through your right eye, which is connected to your left brain hemisphere, which is where language is situated. Most of language is lateralized in most people on the left side. You get the language-specific effect, but if you do it through the left eye with the right eye closed, you get no effect. Very intriguing. In the late 1990s, it was finally demonstrated that not all languages actually have basic color terms, something that had been heavily disputed for decades, partly thanks to research by Steve Levinson, who showed that the language of Russell Island in Melanesia does not have basic color terms. In fact, many languages don't have them. So that was acknowledged by Paul Kay and Lisa Maffei in 1999. In the meantime, there has been a new strand of research around Debbie Robertson from the University of Essex in England, suggesting that maybe language indeed plays a strong role in color categorization after all. In response, Terry Regier and Paul Kay and colleagues developed new statistical methods of testing the similarity among color categories, color categorizations in the World Color Survey, which was an analysis of the color term systems of over 100 languages conducted originally in the 1970s. And Regier and colleagues found that yes, there are universal principles of lexicalization of color, contrary to Debbie Robertson's and colleagues' claims. So this is all ongoing research, all very controversial, but you see how you can get from cross-linguistic semantics directly to cognition and even neurocognition. Second domain, very briefly, because we're running out of time, spatial frames of reference, also something we'll discuss in a lot more detail in later lectures. Until the 1970s, it was assumed that all human populations have a universal innate bias towards using relative egocentric frames of reference in small-scale space. So they would all, let's say, represent the position of people in the audience in front of them in terms of left and right. Or in terms of front and back relative to where they, as speakers, are located. So then it was, it began to emerge in the 1970s that a lot of Australian Aboriginal populations represent everything in terms of cardinal directions linguistically. And not long afterwards, John Haviland was able to show that that also extends to gestural representations. So gestural iconic representations of real world events in story narratives turned out to be oriented absolutely so as to preserve the cardinal directions of the represented event in the gesture. And that then led Steve Levinson and colleagues to do a lot of work on indigenous languages of Mexico and Australia and Namibia and other parts of the world and demonstrate that preferences for particular strategies of spatial orientation in discourse, in language, align with preferences in speakers of these languages in how they memorize spatial information. So they use the same frames of reference, the same strategies in language and in recall memory. They also demonstrated that speakers of languages that have a bias in favor of absolute orientation, geocentric orientation, tend to be better dead reckoners, meaning they are much better than speakers of, let's say, languages that prefer egocentric or intrinsic orientation in terms of keeping track of how their bearings change as they move through space. Levinson and Pedersen and colleagues explained that in terms of a language on thought effect, a Worfian effect of language on internal cognition. Peggy Lee and Lilac Lightman and colleagues pushed back against that, arguing instead, no, it's not language influencing internal cognition, rather it's culture influencing both language and internal cognition. And we're going to spend an entire lecture, I think lecture number 8, to talk about this ongoing debate, which is very interesting. And a lot of my own current active research is on this particular debate. Daniel Howe, in 2006, with a team of researchers, showed that non-human primates, chimps, bonobos, gorillas, and so forth, have a preference for geocentric cognition, which is very interesting given that until a few decades ago, it was assumed that egocentric cognition was innate in modern humans, which would mean that most likely, if that were true, which nowadays very few people still believe, but if that were true, then preferences for spatial orientation would have had to be encoded genetically at least twice in the hominid lineage. And finally, most recently, Daniel Hahn and colleagues demonstrated that it's actually difficult to train children who have been growing up using predominantly geocentric frames of reference to use egocentric frames of reference instead, and vice versa. So they worked with a group of around 5-year-old kids in Namibia who are growing up in a community that prefers geocentric orientation. and try to teach them relative terms and to solve a task of non-linguistic reasoning in relative terms. And conversely, they try to teach a group of Dutch kids who grow up with an egocentric bias to use use a geocentric strategy to solve the task. And in both cases, the kids perform below chance. Okay, and the final example I wanted to give comes from research on motion representations, which started a long time ago with Len Talmies, also another speaker here at the lectures. Len Talmies' doctoral research on Atsugewi, a Californian indigenous language, a presumed member of the hypothetical Hokan stock. Len noticed that Atsugewi classifies motion in terms of properties of the figure, the moving object. So they have different motion verbs for, let's say, round objects and flat objects and so on and so forth. He then went on to compare that to English, which often conflates the manner in which an object moves, whether it's running or walking or rolling or swimming and so on and so forth, two languages such as Spanish or Russian, Turkish, Japanese and so on, which conflate the path of motion in the main verb. So they talk about entering, ascending, descending and so on and so forth. And then there are languages such as Mandarin, which use verbs for both of these things. In the 1990s, Dan Slobin began to show that the syntactic type of a language, in terms of Talmies' typology, has an influence on how speakers of the particular languages prepare their non-linguistic thoughts when they're trying to talk about motion events. So the speakers of languages that conflate manner of motion talk a lot more about manner of motion than the speakers of languages that conflate the path of the motion event. Since then, a lot of different people, including myself with a team of researchers, have been trying to test whether this has an influence on the non-linguistic categorization of motion events. There's also a syntactic side to Talmies' typology, although Talmies talked about it primarily in terms of lexicalization, which has been examined by a lot of different people, including Bhuvananarasimhan. In more recent research, a bunch of colleagues and myself showed that the different linguistic types for motion event framing actually impose different constraints on the events that get represented as simple events, if you will, in these languages. So whereas an English speaker would take it for granted that motion from point A to point B is a single simple event, whatever that means, because in English you can represent that as a single simple clause, in Yucatec Maya and many other languages you have to use a minimum of two clauses. You have to say it left point A and then and it reached point B. You can't just say it went from point A to point B. And we'll be talking about that in lecture 9. There has been some new research by Dan Slobin and Melissa Baumann and colleagues showing that children are sensitive to these different patterns of typological patterns of motion framing at a very, very young age. And of course, language acquisition research or language child language developmental research is always an important companion to semantic typology in that if we assume that there are certain universal principles underlying the linguistic representation in a given domain, then we should expect that children, all children, regardless of what language they learn, start out with these universal principles and only diverge in language-specific ways relatively later. Whereas what these people found is that, no, even at the very earliest stages that they looked at, the kids already were language specifically, which is arguments with evidence against these universal principles in this case. All right, so overview over the remaining lectures. We've already done that pretty much. So this one is over right now, almost. We're going to continue this afternoon with field semantics, and that's going to be our topic for tomorrow as well, both lectures tomorrow. Then we'll move on to ethnosemantics or cognitive anthropology, which is the approach to semantic categorization that was pioneered in anthropology in the mid-20th century. But there's been a lot of new research recently. You can think of it as a precursor to semantic typology. So then I talk a little bit about semantic typology itself, methods and critical issues. And then we move on. This is the one where we talk about this debate between Levinson and Patterson and Majid and myself and a lot of other people on the one side, and Peggy Lee, Lala Gleitman, Anna Papafragu, and so on and so forth on the other side about language as a possible factor in shaping internal cognition. Then I have a whole lecture that's devoted to new quantitative approaches, statistical methods, which is becoming ever more important in all areas of linguistic typology, not just in semantic typology. And we'll take a look at some recent signature studies. Lecture 9 will be devoted to event description. That's this line of research on event segmentation that came out of the Tami typology, which we just looked at. And in lecture 10, I'm going to try to sum up the available evidence for just how much variation there is across languages in terms of the linguistic representation of the world. And I'm going to go into one more particular study of mine, which looks at evidence for deep cross-linguistic variation in what Jackendorf calls conceptual structure. So, of course, somebody like Ray Jackendorf proposes a model of semantics with the idea that not necessarily all of it is universal and innate, but there's a core which is not language-specific or culture-specific, and then somebody like me grabs this model and runs with it and uses it to poke holes in it and show that, as a matter of fact, some of the things that we have assumed to be not language-specific and therefore probably innate does in fact vary with language and therefore is almost certainly cultural. And at that point we come full circle, because that's how we started out today. All right, so that's it. Quick summary, field research is the data gathering in situ, meaning wherever the phenomenon occurs. Field research in linguistics means data gathering from the speakers of the language. Field semantics is the gathering of data for semantic research in the field from speakers of the language for the purposes of language documentation, description, and theoretically driven research, and of course also for the purposes of semantic typology. Semantic typology is the cross-linguistic study of semantic categorization, meaning the search for universals and variation in how different languages represent reality. Representation means one entity or state of affairs standing for another entity. Meaning is the content of the representation. Cognition is the generation and processing of these representations in a cognitive agent. Culture is the social sharing and transmission of knowledge and practices. Cross-linguistic evidence can serve as, cross-linguistic variation can serve as evidence, indirect evidence of cultural transmission for the reasons that we discussed. All right, now that's it. Thanks so far.